It's time to unleash your inner cowboy with the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Now here's your host, Alyssa Barnes.
Hello, Earn Your Spurs listeners. Welcome to episode number 27 of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I am your host, Alyssa Barnes. Today, my guest is Carrie Lynn Dell. Carrie lives on a ranch up outside of Cut Bank, Montana, which is just south of the Canadian border. She actually had to drive into Cut Bank, which is an hour from the ranch, just to use the internet at the library because her internet home is a little sketchy. Now, Carrie is a woman who wears a lot of hats. She not only helps her husband run her family's ranch, but she's also an author and a mom, so she's a pretty busy lady. And she just put out her first novel, The Long Ride Home. In this interview, Carrie and I talk about what it was like to grow up on a ranch on the Blackfoot Indian Reservation outside of Cut Bank, what it's like today working with her husband to run the family ranch, and we also talk about what her new book is about, which sounds really interesting. You will actually have a chance to win a copy of her book for free. I'll give you the details at the end of this episode. Without further ado, allow me to introduce you to Carrie Lynn Dell. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show today. It's pretty cool to have you here and talk about some real authentic ranch stories.
We are authentic, let me tell you.
You seem to be a woman that wears a lot of hats.
I'm, you know, kind of cutting down a little bit, actually. Until the 1st of June, I had a full-time job in town. And so I was a medical biller at our community health center. I pretty much was the billing department. I had one person that helped me with the dental side of things, but otherwise I did all the billing, coding, and all of that. And then the 1st of June, I got to retire and become a ranch hand. So
nice. Well, why don't you tell us just about kind of how you grew up on the ranch and sort of what led you to where you are and what you're doing today?
Well, our ranch is on the Blackfeet Reservation, and we border Canada. So our house is about a mile from the Canadian border. When you look north from our house, pretty much everything you see, all the ridges and stuff, are all on the Canadian side. So when you look north, you see Canada. When you look west, you see Glacier National Park. We're about 15 miles from the east front of Glacier Park. And it's kind of unique there because there really are no foothills. So you're either in the mountains or you're on the prairie. There's not a whole lot of transition in between. Our property includes some of the original Blackfeet tribal allotments for my grandmother's brothers. My grandmother's allotment is part of my cousin's ranch, but the allotments of a couple of her brothers are parts of them are in our property. So it's the third generation to be on this particular ranch. My great-grandfather settled on the Canadian side of the line, and so we can, from my living room window, also see the house and the lights of where their original rock house was.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. There's some definitely some history there then.
Yep, and my great-grandfather was, he had the teams of horses. A teamster, basically, the old style teamster. He hauled hay and did dirt work or any kind of hauling that needed to be done. And he was on his way to Saskatchewan and was going to settle out in Saskatchewan. And he had been hauling up what was kind of a branch of the Oregon Trail that came up north and into Alberta, and hauling in materials for people who were homesteading in the area. And he was going to go on from there to Saskatchewan. And they told him, you know, don't leave this. They're just about to open up this country to homesteading. So he stayed and homesteaded in southern Alberta And then my grandfather, when they handed out the tribal allotments, he and my grandmother moved across the border into Montana and started working down there. So that was in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So my family's been around there for a long time. And then on my mother's side, we are Blackfeet. So the farthest back they've traced our lineage is to back in the years of Fort Benton. And I don't have the sheet in front of me. I don't remember the years exactly, but a group of soldiers from Fort Benton came upon a Blackfeet hunting camp that had been attacked by Assiniboine, and there was one survivor, was a little girl. And so they took her back to the Fort Benton. Her name was Under Fox Woman. The someone at the fort, either the minister or the whoever was in charge of the fort, basically adopted her. And then she ended up marrying a trader named Tin Cup Joe DeBray. And that is where the Blackfeet line comes into our family.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So your family has lived on that land for a long time.
Yeah, well, my grandmother's family, who knows how long. I took a friend out one time I had a friend from Oregon who came to visit, and I told him, come on out, I'll show you where my ancestors used to live. So I took him out in the middle of the pasture and showed him the teepee rings. He was expecting a log cabin.
Well, I think the teepee rings are a little cooler than a log cabin. So you grew up on the ranch, and that's pretty much the only life you've ever known.
Yeah, I haven't been there the whole time. I grew up there. My parents didn't live there when I was born. My mom had gone to college. She met my dad. He was, like I said, from Ennis. That part of Montana is actually the only part of Montana where there are no Indian reservations. He had never been on an Indian reservation until he met my mother. And then he graduated from college, and his first teaching degree was in Harlem, or his first teaching job. And they were there for about 6 years, I think. And then right before I was born, they moved to this area. So I'm the only one in our family that was actually born in Cutting. And then he taught and coached in Browning for a year, I think. And then my grandfather died, and we moved out to the ranch when I was about 4 years old. So I didn't actually live there from the time I was a baby.
Well, that's pretty close. I mean,
yeah. Well, and we spent a lot of time, and we lived in Browning, but we also worked summers, and, you know, they were helping my grandparents all the time. So I don't have a lot of memories of living anywhere else as far as when I was growing up.
So what was that like for you growing up on the ranch like that? I mean, I'm sure being in Cut Bank, that was kind of the norm around there for people, but can you talk about kind of some of those experiences?
You know, that's a really strange thing because there's this assumption that if you live in a small town in Montana, you know all about farming, you know all about ranching, you're kind of a cowgirl. And that is so far from the truth. You know, I have a friend that I worked with when I was working in medical billing, and she grew up in Cut Bank. She's lived here her whole life except when she went to college in Helena. And she knows nothing about horses, cattle. She is a complete city girl. So, you know, small town Montana does not equal rural or ranch. So when I was in high school, to start with, we went to a country school. So we had a school that was about 12 miles from our house. And there were the largest it ever was while I went there was, I think we had 15 kids in the first through the eighth grade. And the most kids in my class was three. By the time I finished, we went there through the eighth grade, and I finished the eighth grade. I like to say I graduated first in my class. I also graduated last in my class because I was the only one. We were really isolated. I actually, when I started high school in Cut Bank, I only knew maybe half a dozen people well enough to really talk to them. It was really like moving to a complete new town because we didn't, other than through 4-H and a few other things like that, we really didn't interact much with the kids in Cut Bank. So
yeah,
we were, to put it bluntly, we were total hicks. And at that time, hick was not cool in this town. So it was really a transition to come in here and go to school and try to fit in.
I bet. And, you know, I think a lot of people probably don't realize that, you know, you can feel like such an outsider when you kind of grow up differently than everyone else. And so many people are envious of that life and, you know, wanting to have that romance of being on a ranch and the kids learning that work ethic. And, you know, that's another side of it that people don't realize, that you can feel really isolated and like you're different than everyone else too.
Well, yeah. And, you know, it really was like a kind of a class system in this town at that time. There was a lot of oil money in Cut Bank when I was in high school. The economy of the town revolved around oil and other industries. Agriculture was kind of second class. And so therefore the kids from the country, you know, unless you were a really good athlete or something, it was really, really hard to fit in. And it's that certain size of school where the cliques really can rule, because it's just big enough for that. You know, you get into a smaller school, everybody has to get along because there's only so many of you. And you get into bigger schools and you can kind of find your group. But in a school where there's 75 kids in your class, you kind of have to try to fit into the flow. And so it was rodeo and horses and ranching and all of that. It just wasn't cool when I was in high school. And so that was, I always kind of tried to downplay that part. I didn't talk about, you know, the rodeos that I went to in the summer. I had kind of two completely different lives. I had my town life, and then I had my life and my friends at the rodeos, and the two didn't mix. There was no one else. There was one other girl my age from here who high school rodeoed. So there really wasn't any commingling of those two parts of my life didn't really mix. And because of that, because it was, I mean, it was actually kind of a stigma. It was like they called us the kickers. I'm sorry for the language, but that's what they called us. And when I started writing, about, you know, rodeo and Western stuff, but it took my agent a long time to convince me that people really thought this was cool. I mean, I was trying to write other stuff and she kept saying, I want more rodeo stuff. I want more ranch stuff. I mean, how? I want to write this cool stuff. She goes, this is the cool stuff. This is what people want to read. So it took me a long time to actually get past that. And I finally realized I'm still stuck back in high school where it wasn't cool to be one of the kickers. I graduated from Montana State after wandering through four different degrees and went into sports medicine. And it happened at the time that I graduated, one of the best places to get a job was in Texas, because Texas mandated that every high school over a certain size had to have a certified athletic trainer on staff. So they had not only good jobs, but they paid well. And so my first job out of college was in Grand Prairie, Texas, which is a suburb of Dallas. So I went from Cut Bank, which at the time had a population of about 4,000 people, to a high school that had a population of 2,500.
Yeah. So
in the middle of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. And down there, it was sort of the same way. There was sort of this segregation. They had the group they called the Ropers, is what they called them down there. And they were the guys who wore the boots and the hats and the Western shirts and stuff. And they were the Ropers.
So when you got down to Texas, did you rodeo and stuff down there?
I did a little bit. I didn't really have a horse at that moment, a barrel horse. I had been primarily a barrel racer growing up. One of the downsides of where we live is it's a very long ways to most of the Montana rodeos. And especially at that time, any kind of junior rodeos and stuff. Our high school rodeos at that time consisted of, you went to district and it was two rounds and an average. And if you're in the top four, you went to state and it was two rounds and an average. And if you're in the top four, you went to nationals. And so like now they have, you can count up to 10 high school rodeos. So the high school rodeo you know, they do go to a bunch of them, but they didn't have that when I was in high school, and they didn't really have any junior rodeos in the area. But when we went across the border into southern Alberta, it's way more populated in southern Alberta, just north of us. And there's probably within a 100-mile radius of where we live, I would say there's probably 30 or 40 rodeos of different types. We're only 3 hours from Calgary, so.
Mm.
But Canadians didn't rope much. They didn't have breakaway roping. We never, ever went anywhere where they had goat tying, but they had junior barrel racing at all the rodeos we went to. So we were all barrel racers, and we didn't really rope much. I don't think I ever even entered the breakaway roping in high school. I was a barrel racer and a pole bender. And then I got into college, and they put me on the rodeo team, had a good barrel horse, and said, you are going to learn how to tie goats and rope because we need to do more than one event. So I started, did a lot of goat tying my first year and roped also because my dad's a roper who had rope horses, and I had team roped and roped. You know, it's not like I'd never picked up a rope. We roped at home, but I hadn't competed.
Mm-hmm.
And about halfway through college is when I started running out of barrel horses. The horse that I had was getting old. The young ones weren't really coming along. And so I decided to get serious about roping because I figured goat tying, when you get done with college, you're done. There's really no other place to go compete unless you live in North Dakota. North Dakota has goat tying in their, South Dakota. South Dakota has goat tying at their amateur rodeos. But so I decided to get serious about roping. And so about the time that I got done with college, I didn't have a horse that was even good enough really to rodeo on as far as barrel racing. And didn't, moving down there, know anybody or have any place that I could take a horse and keep it. So for the first 6 months or so that I was down there, I didn't have a horse with me at all. Mm. And then I bought a barrel horse down there and started going to some jackpots and stuff. I went to the Mesquite Championship Rodeo one time, which I just wanted to go say I'd gone.
Yeah.
And I went to the weekly rodeo at the Fort Worth Coliseum at the Stockyards one time. Same deal. It's like my horse really wasn't that caliber. I just wanted to go see what it was like. So
yeah. Well, you might as well take advantage if you're there anyway.
Yeah, but I didn't. And I went to quite a few barrel racing jackpots, but I didn't actually rodeo down there. And that job was both teaching and as I was the assistant athletic trainer. I wasn't even the only athletic trainer at that high school. But the teaching end of things was not good. I looked like I was about 16 years old, and those kids, they have this great system where they give the youngest teachers the worst kids. I only lasted a year in Texas. I never spent a summer in Texas, which is probably good because I moved there in August, and like the first week I was there, it got up to 110, and I honestly thought I might die. So I don't know what I would have done in July.
Yeah, that's pretty rough for a Montana gal to deal with all that humidity, I think.
Yeah, I had never experienced humidity really like that before. It was definitely that feeling of never being not sweaty and hot. I mean, like you take a shower, walk out the door. That was hard to get used to. So I never thought I'd actually get to the point where I craved a day cold enough to wear a sweatshirt, but I did when I looked down there.
So, when you left Texas, did you go back to the ranch?
I went back for the summer because I was working for a high school. So I had my summers off. I went back for the summer. And after I went home, I decided not to go back. For whatever reason, it was just kind of a paperwork thing. They hadn't renewed my contract yet. They just hadn't got it done and ready for me to sign before I left. And then after I got back to Montana, it was too late. I just kind of went, no, and it was just the teaching part. I was just so stressed out about the teaching part. I was having nightmares about going back and teaching again. And I thought that's probably not a good sign.
Yeah.
So ended up, I quit my job and I was back on the ranch for a while. Then I got a job in Eastern South Dakota by way of someone I graduated with. They had an athletic trainer who quit at the last minute, and it was a clinic-based job where he worked in the physical therapy clinic during the day, and then they lent you out to the high school in the evenings for all their sports and stuff. And so that was Aberdeen, South Dakota. and flat. Flat. If you think Fargo, flat. The cross country team to train hills ran back and forth over the underpass. So that was a little bit of a shock. And it was also a shock to realize that the winters are worse in eastern South Dakota than they are here.
Yeah.
They don't get what we call Chinook. So these, like, where it's 50 degrees in February, like it is right now. That's not like that out in the eastern Dakotas. They're still cold. Mm-hmm. So, I met my husband there and I stayed there 8 years. And then the winter of 97 was the worst winter on record. Some of the worst cattle markets that had been for ages. And he had a feedlot and had reached the point where he was having to work on the side to make ends meet. And he said, you know what? If I have to have a job, I might as well get a good job and we might as well live someplace where the weather's nice. There's more rodeos close by. We can rope outside most of the year. And so we ended up moving to Hermiston, Oregon, because my sister at the time was living in Pendleton and they really, really liked that area. And she said, well, you know, shoot, people here rope pretty much all winter long in their outdoor arenas. So we ended up, I got an athletic training job at Pendleton High School. We spent 10 years in Oregon and then sort of got to that point where we either needed to buy a house and kind of get invested and start building some equity there or move back to the ranch because my parents were getting to the point where they needed the help. And so we made the decision to move back to the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
So, and part of that was because we were getting to the age where we were ready to slow down with the rodeo. And we rodeoed, you know, on a regional level pretty hard since we got married. And we reached the point where, you know, when everybody else in your event's 20 years younger than you and all your friends are gone taking their kids to the high school rodeos, you kind of start thinking, okay, maybe it's time to do something different. So.
Yeah. And so now, are you and your husband running the ranch today then?
It's sort of a partnership. My dad is still very actively involved, and my mom. My husband is, I guess you would say, the foreman. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't make decisions by himself. He runs everything by my dad for the most part. But we're getting kind of more that direction all the time. Just because my parents are at the point where they would like to be able to get away more. So,
right.
My parents still run the majority. We have a small cow herd of our own, but the majority of the cattle belong to them. So,
mm-hmm. Well, it has to be nice right now for you guys with the cattle market up at the moment. I mean, that doesn't happen all the time.
You know, and this is so contrary to everything else in our life, but we managed to time it perfectly. We moved back right when the cattle market was starting to recover. And so we moved back and we bought, I think, 30 head of cows from my uncle. I have an uncle that goes out of the cow business about once every 10 years. And then he gets bored and buys more and starts over. And so he was in one of his sick of these damn cows modes. And so he sold us his 30 head of registered cows. And that was where we got our start as far as our cow herd goes. And that was kind of at the bottom of the market. And they have been going steadily up ever since. So if we just got into it right at the perfect time. So,
yeah. That doesn't happen very often.
No, we're usually the ones who buy high and sell low, you know. So that was really lucky for us because we got a really nice bunch of cows to kind of as our foundation.
So you said you started calving last week?
Yes, we had our first calf on Valentine's Day.
Oh, nice. That's a nice Valentine's Day for us.
It was a very nice Valentine's Day because he was out of one of our very well-bred purebred heifers and well-bred on both sides, and it was a bull calf. And so he's already our future heifer bull. I mean, he's already got his spot reserved. So, and my online on Facebook, and I put pictures on Facebook and on my blog, and So they nicknamed him Valentino. So I'm sure that will probably stick. We don't normally name our cows and stuff, but a few odd ones get tagged with some kind of a nickname, and he'll probably be one of them.
That's pretty cute. So what would you say a typical day on the ranch looks like for you?
We start out in the morning. We have to get up at like 5:45 to get our kid on the school bus. We have a 12-mile drive to meet the bus, and we have to meet the bus at 7 in the morning.
Wow.
They leave the house at 6:30, and I sit down, and that's when I try to get in my writing. 6:30 to about 8:30 is my writing time, and that's the time when I try to work on my novels. Try not to check my internet, not to check my email, because that's just can suck you down. And the next thing you know, it's time to go do the chores and haven't gotten anything done on the manuscript. So I get up in the morning and I write first, and then we go out and do the chores. We are not crack of dawn people. All of those advertisements you see about this farmer who's been up since 4:00 this morning, that is not my family. We are across the board unanimously not morning people. And so we figure if there's, you know, one good point of being self-employed, it's that you can get up when you want. So we don't blast out of the house at 6:00 in the morning and start. We go at probably 8:30. We get out there and start doing chores. And we have, we keep all of our heifer calves. We don't sell any of them when we wean in the fall. And so we've got them all in the feedlot. And then these calves that are being born now, these are registered calves. We breed our registered cows to calve the earliest, because those bulls have to be old enough to be our herd bulls for next year. Mm. And so they need to be born basically that before the 1st of March. We AI those cows, and only the bulls that are AI'd are the only ones that we keep. And so this first 2 weeks is kind of the big time, because this is when we see what we're going to get for next year's herd bulls. Are we going to get enough bull calves? Are they going to be the ones born early? Are they going to be the right ones out of the right kind of cows? This is when you find out how many of your cows actually bred via AI versus, you know, you AI them, and then you turn them out with the bulls, and anything that didn't catch with the AI, the bulls will breed. So if they're born in a certain time frame in this first 2 weeks, then they had to have been AI'd. If they're on the borderline, then you take hair samples and you send it into the Angus Association, and they do DNA testing and tell you whether or not. You tell them what bull they were out of, and they tell you whether or not they were actually an AI calf or were they out of one of the herd bulls.
Hmm.
And so we have an indoor arena, and we start calving in February. And if the weather is at all cold or snowy or anything, all the cows go inside the indoor arena at night. So when we have calves born at night, they're bedded down in straw. They're pretty spoiled. So our cows are so spoiled that they actually go in. We've had great weather the last few days. It's been in the 40s and sunny. And we have the gates open so they can just go in and out of the calving pasture, and they can walk in and out of the arena. And the cows will actually come in and go in the arena to have their calves. The older cows that have been around a while, they're so used to it. And you know, they'll walk in there and lay down in the straw and have their calves. So it works really well. And then they will calve through probably about the middle of March. And then about that time, our first calf heifers that are not purebreds will start calving. And we breed them to calve from the middle of March to about the 1st of April. So again, we've kind of got a smaller group. We can put them all inside when we need to. And then the 1st of April, our bigger commercial herd calves. So we calve for like a quarter of the year. We calve for a little over 3 months.
Mm. What kind of cattle do you raise?
We have all Black Angus at this point.
Oh, okay.
And a small herd of Longhorns. They are such cool cows. I mean, sometimes you wish you could do all Longhorns.
Yeah.
They never get sick. They never have trouble calving. They very rarely ever lose a calf, a longhorn calf. They're just really, really genetically, you know, the whole survival of the fittest thing. Longhorns were one of the last to be domesticated, so they really have the whole survival thing down. They can be a little difficult to work with at times.
Yeah.
they're a little wild and stuff, but they're cool and they're pretty.
They are. They're beautiful. We used to raise some when I was younger, and there were, they, it seemed like a lot of them had names based on their personalities, and there were some ornery ones for sure, but they were a lot of fun.
We, right now, we don't have any, we have a couple that I sort of always kind of keep one eye on, but they've never ever really done anything. But we don't even bother to try to tag their calves. Most of our calves, as soon as they're born or within, you know, as soon as they're up and around, they get an ear tag that matches their mother's tag number so that if we have a storm and they get separated, we can match them back up again. And we give them some probiotic paste to help them kind of fight off scours and stomach problems. Mm-hmm. And they get an ear tag, and then we rubber band our bull calves as soon as newborns. So we don't do any castrating at branding time. They've been rubber banded. We have found that when you rubber band them as brand new babies, it's way less stressful. They don't even seem to notice it.
Mm-hmm.
So, whereas when you castrate it by branding time, you have to worry about flies, and it's just seems to be way more stress for the calf.
But you miss out on the Rocky Mountain oyster feed.
You know, I don't. I don't miss it. I hate to say, but that's never been any big deal in our family. Nobody in our family really has ever gotten into that. So,
what is it like kind of working as a team with your husband on the ranch?
We do most of the time. We work together really well. We think a lot alike. And we have sort of the same way of going about things. And so most of the time we do really well. There are days when, you know, words are exchanged. One or the other of us is a little cranky or, but we do pretty good most of the time. I write a humor column. It's that kind of a farm and ranch and just general family humor that there's some newspapers up in this area. And one of them was about, working with him, and he's always on the tractor and I'm always chugging around on foot. And that's partly because he has a bad knee. So chugging around on foot is harder for him. And I like to get the exercise, but when he's up on the tractor and we're waving and we're doing all these hand signals and he's looking at me like, what the, are you trying to tell me? And I'm waving my hands, do this, do that, and trying to tell, you know, tell him you need to tip the bucket up and then lower it and then tilt it this way. And on his part, his way of communicating is whenever he wants to get my attention, he revs the tractor. And there was one day we were out and we were bedding, there was a storm coming and we were bedding shelters down and gathering calves and trying to get everything fed. And it was just one of those days when everybody was going as fast as they could and cranky because we knew this big storm was coming. And it was, I literally got to the point where it's like, if you rev that engine at me one more time, one more, I'm coming up there. So, and it was funny because I wrote this in my newspaper column, and the newspaper just got, and my blog and stuff just got flooded with people, wives going, oh my God, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think most ranch wives have a story or two about getting into it with the husband or something.
Yeah.
I know that my parents, when I was, well, probably even before I was born, because my mom kind of quit helping my dad after that. They had some moments where, usually when sorting cattle, that dad would get mad at, or he would yell at mom, and mom would say, well, fine, you can do it yourself then, and just leave him.
Yeah. So. My mom never walked away. My mom stayed around. So, but, you know, my mom was always really involved in, you know, the decision making. And, you know, so when we were sorting and doing things like that, their arguments are always about, you know, are we keeping this cow? Are we not keeping this cow? You know, those kinds of things. So they were actually business decisions that were being decided while you're standing ankle deep in muck.
Yeah, right.
Cows running back and forth, trying to run you over and stuff. And they're debating these business matters in the middle of the corral. So, but now Greg is, my husband is more plans ahead more. So like when he goes out to the corral and we're going to go sort heifers, he's already got his list of these are the ones that go here and these are the ones that go there. And, you know, so there's, we don't really have that kind of, those kind of arguments because he's already decided all that stuff. And because of the fact that I have the town job, I haven't really been involved on a day-to-day basis. And so on, when it comes to most of that kind of decision-making, he just knows the cows way better than I do. So for now, I don't have offer too much input when it comes to that kind of stuff. I mostly just do what I'm told. So when I remember to, I have a bad habit of, you know, probably the most, you know, common thing, and he's really actually pretty patient about most of it, but it's not that I don't listen. It's not always that I don't listen. There's kind of two versions of this. Sometimes it's that I'm working on something on the computer, and, you know, my body may be sitting in this chair, but my brain is in the panhandle of Texas right now at a rodeo, and we're going to have a big wreck, and my character is going to get wiped out of me, and my husband is over here as he's walking out the door telling me something, and I will say whatever I have to say to get him to just go away so that I won't break my concentration, and so I'll nod, and I'll say, okay, and then, you know, I finish what I'm doing and think, I have absolutely no idea what he's just said to me. I got something like blah blah blah, work on the pickup, blah blah blah, if I'm done, and I have no idea. So then I have to either, you know, kind of eat crow and go up there and admit that I didn't hear what he said and I have no idea what he wanted me to do, or just kind of go, well, you know, if it was really important, he'd be back down here by now. And so, like, the other day, it was actually, what he told me was, if I'm done working on the pickup, I'm going to come to town with you. So luckily, he came back before I left for town, because I had totally not heard that at all. I would have left him. Other times, there's things like the one day we're hauling hay right now when we can. We're running a little short on hay, and we have a neighbor. The last year was like heaven for the cow people in this area, and one of the worst years ever for the farmers. They got hail. They got snowed on. They had some kind of wheat smut. They got a bunch of rain in September that actually caused the grain to sprout in the heads. It was that we had farmers all around us who had to just completely write off their crops. And so after they'd write off their barley crop, they still got to do something with it. So they'd go in and swath and bale it, or else, you know, allow one of the ranchers to swath and bale it. So one of our neighbors swathed and baled all his barley and didn't do anything with it. He has cows of his own, and so I think he was going to haul it home and never got around to it. And it's actually much closer to our house than it is to his. And so he called the other day because my mom had said something about we were going to need to hay. And he called the other day and said, would you like to buy that hay? So it's still in the field, and it's February.
Oh, geez.
And it's this field that runs down. We have this big, it's like you have the Rocky Mountain front, and then about 20 miles out, there's this big ridge that runs parallel to it. And it probably runs, you know, 10, 15 miles long. And if you can picture a big sheet of ice during the ice age creeping out from the glacier park and pushing up a big ridge of dirt and rock and stuff in front of it, and then the ice age ended and the ice melted, that ridge is that big mound of rock that the ice sheets pushed up. And so it's just kind of scooped out all the way from where we live all the way up to the mountains. So it makes the views really spectacular. But his field is kind of at the base of this hill, this ridge, and it's a 200-foot ridge. And our truck doesn't have four-wheel drive. And so we pretty much went into this assuming that Greg, the only way to get out of this field is to go up this little dirt track up that ridge. And we assumed that Greg was going to have to push me out of there. So the first thing he says as he's leaving the house, he says, I'm going to take off in the tractor, give him about half an hour because it'll take me that much longer to get down there than it will you in the truck. And don't forget, I set the emergency brake. I get all the way down there. I get the first load hauled, get out of there, up to the top of the hill, ready, and I come back for the second load, and the truck kept stalling on me. Every time I would take a foot up the gas, the truck would stall, and I was just getting furious. And so he crawls up there, and he said, what's the problem? I said, the truck keeps stalling, and then when it stalls, I have no brakes, and I have no nothing, and I'm headed down this big ridge. And he gets in there, and he says, maybe if you took the emergency brake off, it would help. Oh, yeah. You mentioned something about that, didn't you? So, you know, sometimes it's that I literally don't hear him, and sometimes it's that it just doesn't, there's no retention. Whatever he said to me, I fully intended to do, but half an hour later, I have no recollection of it. But I told him, you know, it's crowded inside my head. I've got like four books worth of people living in here talking to me.
I definitely understand that. So tell us a little bit about your book that you just published. That's your first novel, right?
This is. It's my first published novel. It is not by far the first I've written, but it's my first published novel. And it kind of, oddly enough, it's the only one I've written that's set here at home, even in Montana, actually. And it was my first published one. And it was kind of a fluke that it happened to be. A friend of mine read it and said, I think that this is absolutely something my editor would love. I want to refer it to directly to her. We'll bypass all the usual rigmarole, and I'll just tell her I want her to read this book because I think she'll love it. And she did, and they bought it. So
that's awesome.
So it's actually set in Browning. And I asked them when we got into the editorial process, I said, one of my first questions was, usually they make up a fake name for the town, and you know, they don't like to talk about real places because they don't want anybody complaining that they're being libeled or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And so I told the editor, well, here's the deal. I said, the book, the way I wrote it, is Browning. I mean, I name specific places and businesses and things and around Browning. And I said, I can make up a fictional town if you want, but the plot doesn't work unless this book is set on the Blackfeet Reservation, and there is only one town on the Blackfeet Reservation, so we can call it whatever we want. Everybody's going to know it's Brown. And so she said, I've read it. I don't think there's anything in there that anyone can sue us for. So, you know, she said, it's not like it is, it's the word of libelous. It doesn't really paint the town in a horrible light or anything like that, or any of the people there. So we went ahead and published that way. And so far the feedback has been good. Most of the people I've heard from who live in Browning or that I know from that area said, yeah, that's pretty much Browning. Good, bad, and otherwise, that's it. So
can you tell us a little bit about what the book is about?
It's inspired by a true story about, and this happened way back in the 80s, and I don't remember all the details. You know, I read about it. Now my husband and I both remember different versions. I don't know who's right, but the basic premise is this guy, professional calf roper, one of the best ropers in the country at the time, was at a rodeo in the Midwest, and calf roping was toward the end of the rodeo, and right as the rodeo ended, they shut down all the lights so that they could have some kind of closing ceremony. And so the calf ropers all just took their horses out back, tied them up, and went back, watched the closing ceremony, and then came back to put their horses away when they turned the lights back on. and he came back and his horse was gone. And,
wow.
They didn't find it. They never found it. And they did find his saddle, and several years later, he got a phone call from a friend who said, "I'm at a rodeo." I remember it as being the Missouri State High School Rodeo. Greg says he thinks it was at Denver, but either way, it was, "I'm at a rodeo, and this kid just rode your horse into the arena." The horse had a really distinctive Freeze brand that was easy to pick out. And so, as it turned out, probably what happened was the guy who stole him, as soon as they realized it was gone, then it was all over the news, all over the, you know, it was a big, big deal because it was a really valuable horse. And the guy panicked, so he dropped him off at a place with a guy he knew and left and never came back.
Wow.
And so the horse just stood there for like 3 years. And finally, the guy went to the sheriff and said, "What do I do? I've got this horse who's been here all this time. I don't know. The guy obviously isn't coming back." And they said, "Well, at this point, he's abandoned property, so he's yours. He's abandoned, and you've been feeding and taking care of him." And so there were some, who was a professional calf roper who lived down the road, had a couple of sons. His name was Roy Durfee. And the guy asked them if they would like to take the horse and see if they could make a rope horse out of it. And they take the horse and realize, we don't have to make a rope horse out of this horse. You know, and
wow.
But they, you know, had no way of really knowing where he came from or anything. So the older of the two boys was roping on him, and someone saw him and saw the Freeze brand and recognized him. So I took that basic premise. And in that case, you know, the two men knew each other, Roy Durfee and the owner of the horse. They were both professional calf rippers. They'd known each other for years, but they lived, you know, one was in Texas, one in Missouri. And so, they just, when they realized it was Todd Sloan's horse, they just gave him back. And that doesn't make a very good book. So I took that premise and said, who is the worst possible person that it could happen to have him lose this horse? And so in the case of the main character, he's a young guy in his early 20s. He's in his breakout year as a professional roper. He is the hottest young stud on the circuit. He's just had a great 4th of July run. He's at Cody, Wyoming. He goes out, he wins the calf roping, and at the end of the rodeo, they start shooting off fireworks, and the horse spooks and breaks loose and runs away off into the dark, and they don't find him again. And on the flip side, the person who, when they find the horse, who's the worst possible person who could lose the horse once they find it. And in that case, the character I created is a teenager from up here in Browning. You know, his family doesn't have a lot of money. They lucked into this really good horse. He has fetal alcohol syndrome. He really struggles in school. He struggles, you know, with everything. And this horse has been like the miracle for him. He was on the verge of dropping out of school. He was starting to get into drinking a lot. And at the age where his family was sort of losing control, and then they got this horse, the kid got into roping, and it was the thing that kind of brought him back from the edge and gave him a reason to want to stay in school and, you know, keep his life together. Because as long as he was doing that, the horse was kind of the equalizer. He gave him a chance to be successful. And so now you've got a guy whose life pretty much went down the tubes when the horse disappeared. He, you know, financially, personally, he really took a nosedive. Now he's got a chance to get this horse and his career back. And on the flip side, you have a kid who, you know, this is the only success he's ever had in his life. And if he loses this horse, he may lose, you know, basically just go off the rails. They both have pretty high stakes, and there's only one horse, and they have to figure out who and how. And because I write primarily romance, of course, there's got to be a romantic thing in there. And in this case, the teenage custodial aunt And so his mom is in prison for selling meth, and he lives with his aunt. And the aunt will do anything to keep this kid from losing the horse. But, you know, she knows she can't. There's no way he can keep this horse. But she's trying to get salvage something from the situation. Mm-hmm. And so that's really the whole plot of it, is her, the conflict between the three of them. And, you know, who's, how is it all going to work out so that everybody sort of gets some kind of a happy ending? I'm really into happy endings. I'm not a game. I am not a Game of Thrones fan. You kill the horse, you kill the dog, I'm done. So, yeah, I'm still not over Dances with Wolves. I was with them all the way. They killed the horse, they killed the wolf, and then I was done. Like, I don't even care what happened after that.
Well, that sounds like a really interesting book. And I read, you know, a little excerpt on your website, and I mean, it was very well written. So I'm sure anybody that picks it up will have an enjoyable read for sure.
Yeah, it's a little of an anomaly for me. It's a very PG book. The entire book is written from David's point of view, who is the roper who lost the horse. So the entire book is written through his eyes, and he's a very straight-laced, doesn't swear a lot. He's not a partier. He's not a womanizer. And so therefore, the book, if it's written from his point of view, is, you know, pretty clean. There's not much swearing. There's no on-screen sex, as you say. So it's the kind of thing that my mother can hand out to all of her friends and not be embarrassed that her daughter actually thought that up. But that is, that, like I said, that's kind of just the way it happened because of the character I was dealing with. That's not the case in the next books that I have coming up. They are definitely rated R. And they're set in Texas, so that's an interesting story all by itself, how they ended up being set in Texas, because it's a real pain to write about a place that you're not super familiar with. It would have been much easier if I'd set them in like southern Idaho or someplace where I've spent a lot of time. But that just happened to be how it worked out. And like I told my agent at the time, because I wrote the next book first and sent it to her, and then I wrote this book between drafts of that book, because that book has been like a 3-year battle, the next book that I have coming out, to get it right. And so you write it and then you send it off and they read it and then they send it back to you and tell you all of the things that aren't working, and then you write it again, and in between you usually have a couple of months. So in those gaps I wrote this book. And I said, when I finished this one and sent it to her, I said, well, here you go. Because the character, the lead character in the other book's name is Joe. And Joe is a bullfighter. And he is borderline rude and fairly profane. And he is a womanizer. And he is all of the things that David is not. And so when I sent her this book, I said, meet David, the anti-Joe. It's going to be kind of interesting to see, like I said, a lot of the people, especially locally, who read my newspaper column and you see this real family-friendly kind of stuff, and then I release this book, it's very much the same way. And then the next one's going to come out, and it's going to be interesting to see how many of them kind of throw it back at me and say, what is with this?
That sounds like, I mean, it sounds like a great book, and I definitely hope to be able to check it out. Where can people find more information about you online, about your book, about your blog, about anything that you have out there?
I'm really easy to find because my website is just myname.com. So it's just carrielindell.com. And there are links there to pretty much everything. My newsletter, Twitter, Facebook, my blog, everything is right there. I have a fabulous webmistress, and she's got it all lined out. So.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, I'll make sure to include a link to your website in the show notes for this episode so people can find that at earnyourspurs.com. And I just actually have one final question to ask you today. It's the same question I ask all of my guests. And that is, what do you think is the most important quality for any good cowboy to have?
I have thought about this actually. The word that comes to mind is fatalism. And it's, I guess, what the French call c'est la vie. You have to just be able to kind of roll with the punches. There are going to be really bad days, and you have to be able to just say, it's going to happen, and you got to deal with it, and let's move on. And so people who aren't able to accept what comes your way, whether it's from Mother Nature or the cattle market or whatever, they don't last very long in ranching. Because there are so many things you can't control. And so you really have to have that fatalistic attitude of, I'm going to do the best that I can with all of the things that I can control, but I just have to learn to accept the things I can't.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I love that. Well, thank you so much for being here today, Carrie. I think it's really interesting just to hear about, you know, your experiences on the ranch and your books. And I think a lot of people will be excited to check out your new book and the ones that are coming in your blog. And I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Carrie Lynn Dell. I told you at the beginning that you would have a chance to win a copy of her book. So here's what you need to do. The day that this episode is released is February 24th. You will have until March 3rd to go to earnyourspurs.com/episode27. And all you need to do is click on the link that will take you to Carrie's website to register for her newsletter. Once you do that, you'll be entered in a drawing to win a copy of her ebook. So again, go to earnyourspurs.com/episode27. Click on the link that'll take you to Carrie's page to register for her newsletter before March 3rd. And you'll be entered to win a copy of her ebook, The Long Ride Home. Thank you all so much for listening in, and I will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Until next time, happy trails and spur on.